session number 17117, Reel 3.
Mr. Coco, Reel 3.
The reason, I suppose, for our being there soon became apparent when I'm right in saying the very next day we went to sea, and I can remember as we sailed out past Changi, people waving to us, etc., and obviously they themselves were in from Changi, would have been having had the result of a bombing raid on Singapore and heard the news as we had, were equally as apprehensive as we were sailing out, not knowing what of course we're going to face. Anyway, once we were at sea, we were in fact told on, I think, about the second night, the Admiral's intention, and that was of course to intercept the Japanese transports to the north of Malaya. And the object, as he said, that here the Japanese have started their initial landings at Kota Baru, and it is my intention to arrive there at dawn. I can't recall, I think this might have been the dawn on the 10th, but to arrive there to surprise them. He expected the old Japanese battleship Kongo to be there to support the landings and some cruisers, but he said I've no doubt that the anti-aircraft armament would also have some practice, and the whole thing, he did say, depended on the success of the operation, did depend on the element of surprise. Well, that was all he said, really. And then, of course, we walk up and down the upper deck, as one does in the catapult space amidships. And, of course, it was then that an aircraft was seen way, way off on the horizon. And this would be on, I think, about the evening of the 9th. And there was the distinct uneasiness in the ship, as it were, that we were being watched and that the elements of surprise may not, in fact, be achieved. And we already had that feeling that here we are going into this, and we have in fact been seen. Of course, is what is well known and is well documented, the Admiral too during the night realized that and turned back, and I understand from reading the battleship, the book called Battleship, that we were very close, in fact, to engaging some Japanese cruisers if only we'd continued. But anyway, nevertheless, we turned back, and I can remember we closed up several times and stood down again. But we turned back then, and the idea was that we were going back to Singapore. But on the morning of the 10th, it was said the Japanese had been reported as having landed at Kuantan, and we were going to go into there instead of Kota Baru, so that we were going to bite off the smaller cherry instead of the bigger one, I think they put it. Anyway, I can remember that we then we had up spirits. It was 11 o'clock. I didn't drink any rum at that time, but I can remember up spirits at 11 o'clock. And just after 11 o'clock, the bugle sounded again, of an air attack, and that of course is when it all started.
Yes,
we closed up in the turret, and this time of course, though I could wander from P3, that is where the shell came in the Bismarck too, on this occasion I was down in P4. I could alternate between the two turrets. I'd looked into P3 and I went then down into P4, and I was in the working space, the ammunition space of P4, and there I was joined by the sub-lieutenant Franklin, who was also, he was the officer of the quarters of the two turrets, and that was it. We thought, well, what is now? We'd had air attacks before, But of course, being down underneath the below decks, you don't see what is going on up top. All you hear is the clatter of machinery and the shell hoister going and that sort of thing passing up the ammunition. And we open fire. And as we open fire, etc., we'd just about opened fire and have fired a few rounds when suddenly there was just a great, you could hardly say it was a great crash or a bang. It was just like the kind of thud, and the whole ship just seemed to go about 6 foot up in the air and come down again, and just went up and down, and we felt, you know, almost as if we were on a one of those carousels when we were children, going up and down on the hobby horse. And this was absolutely something which we just, and the lights, as this happened, the lights started to fade and started to go out, and it was quite clear that something serious had happened. We'd been hit quite badly, but where, no one quite knew. And the lights went out then, and the secondary lighting came on, which is like little miners' lamps came on. And I can remember the few, you know, the usual comment around, you know. But over in the one side of the space, the working space, where these hoists came up from down below, from the shell rooms and the magazines, there is a ventilation pipe, a curved ventilation pipe with a kind of grill on the end, and water was starting to come out of this. And I went towards this and I tasted it, and it was salt water. And again, that to me, I said to Franklin, God, taste that. And it was salt water, and at the same time we could hear cries coming up through the voice pipe, because in that compartment, that particular one of P4, had direct access down to the shell rooms and to the magazines, because that was the other end of the hoist where the shells were loaded into the hoist to be sent up to us in the working chamber. And you could hear the cries from down there. And I'll never forget that film of In Which We Serve, in which they turn off the, pull the lid down on the voice pipe. And that is one instance which, during the war, one of the many which quite moved me at that, because it was quite clear that they were drowning and that was it. And that was sad. And there's nothing whatever we could talk about that. And from there, of course, we rigged the emergency leads as we could. There were no lights on now at all, except for the emergency lighting, like this little miner's lamp. And of course, we started to list, and the whole ship started to list to port. And I went into the working chamber and called up to the turret, and because they were complaining that they couldn't train the turret, and because all the pumps stopped, all the power went right out, the hydraulic pumps stopped. And I can remember one of my first actions was to open this damn bypass valve in case power started up again, and then I would have had a, you know, a busted pump, as it were. But I opened up this bypass valve, and that was it. There was nothing more that could be done. We couldn't train the turret. You could elevate it a little bit, but there's nothing more that could be done. And I then went outside and went up to P3, my other turret. They were in exactly the same condition up there. And of course, it was afterwards that we learned that this was a torpedo which had hit underneath that part. And it was this torpedo which, of course, did all the damage, because as had been shown recently through that battleship and from the divers had been down on the wreck, that that propeller shaft, as we suspected at the time, was bent by this torpedo, and in oscillating going. It only had to do a few turns, a few revolutions out of centre, and it tore the A bracket off, you know, the thing which supports it at the bottom of the ship, and tore out a large chunk of that side of the ship. So when I went up to P3, exactly the same condition up there. We couldn't train the turret, and that was that. So the turrets were out of action. I then went forward and saw my colleague, and he was in the same boat, but his P1 was just about managing to work. And it transpired that those dynamos forward were less affected than the ones aft. We had 8 dynamos in the ship supplying electric power, but in that torpedo blow, I understand that 4 went off the board. That was completely finished right away, and the 5th one shortly afterwards, which only left 3 working. And of course you must understand as well that with all power going to the turrets, all fans stopped, you know, the fans which supply ventilation down below, everything. So you have a ship in back aft which is, well, in many ways it's dead, it's silent, there's no power on, and there's nothing as eerie as a ship like that, you know. And it's only when we went forward there was a bit of life there, and then of course we started to try to bring some life back in, that here I was joined up then with an ordnance repair party, if we could call it such, with the ordnance lieutenant Gus together, and we got some blocks and tackles, and we tried to get the turrets and started to try to train them, but it was a losing battle, and I'm afraid that there was no way you could possibly do that. And of course so we continued, and so they continued to attack, and so we stopped further torpedoes on the starboard side, and you just heard these, the thumps, and that was it, and very little you could do about it. In the final throes of the ship before it sank, I was on the upper deck then, because S3 and S4 were similarly affected, and I went back to S4 with then they brought in the OAs from the 14-inch turrets, who were, you know, dissing. They weren't the 14-inch, we couldn't use those, and the OAs were that's the ordnance artificers, which are we were just trying to do what we could with these impossible, really, to get these turrets around and train. And we went back to P4, and I can remember the chappie I was with, this Jan Banfield, laddie from St Ives. We looked up and we were just about to walk forward to P3 through the passageway, and we looked up and the superstructure was in our way. But we could see, just passing overhead, a flight of Japanese bombers. And I remember the comment was made, oh, well, here we are now, another lot coming in. But because the superstructure, the aft end and the funnel, etc., looking up from the quarter deck from P4, it blocked our view. We could see the aircraft, but what we could not see were the bombs falling. So as we walked through the passageway, we were walking right to the catapult deck, where, of course, these bombs were falling. And I arrived at the catapult deck, and this Jan Banfield went up the ladder to S3, and he was going up the ladder to S3, and I was about to follow him, and there was this great crash and a bang, and I was swept off my feet. And, in fact, it was the guardrail which saved me from going over the side, and I can remember all the smoke and poking my head over the side of the ship below the level of the deck in order to get my breath, and what, you know, you have that feeling, good heavens, what's that? And this laddie Banfield had slid down, and he'd been hit in the eye with a piece of shrapnel gone up his eye, it's covered in blood, and people were picking themselves up from all the way around the catapult deck, because at that time we had a number of boys from the 2 turrets I was in, the P3 and P4, taking ammunition over their shoulders, carrying it across the rails of the catapult over to S1 and S2, which were still firing at that time. they still had power on those. And the Japanese were supposed, of course, not to be very good aviators. They wore thick glasses, not very experienced flyers at all, and they certainly couldn't bomb. But this lot managed to hit us right dead in the middle of the ship, and we thought that wasn't bad for people who weren't very good. They hit us right in the middle of the catapult rail and right in the middle of the ship, and of course that was it, and that was the last of the time we were hit. And that's when, of course, that just after that, the photograph was taken, as you see on the wall here. You want me to carry on?
That's when you started to abandon ship?
Well, yes, there's no order to abandon ship at all. It was quite clear then that, you know, we were in a very, very bad way. There's no power on the ship. We were just idle. It was absolutely stiflingly hot down below. And after this bomb fell, I can remember a particular ERA I knew, an engine room, walking towards me. And, you know, I spoke to him, and he had a glazed, you know, he just likes. Walked across towards him, almost like a zombie, I might say. I've never seen a zombie, but you know, walked straight. And he didn't answer. And as he walked past, there was a great hole, like a, you know, like a dinner plate in the middle of his back, where he obviously caught some shrapnel from this bomb. And he just went forward, and he went across it, and he collapsed, and he died, and that was it. And it was quite clear then that, you know, there was an awful lot of carnage down below, because this bomb had fallen through the upper deck and had landed on the armoured deck, which was the deck below. And it was there that, of course, the Padre it was giving comfort to the wounded, who were all lying out on the catapult, cinema flat, rather, on the armoured deck. And I'm afraid a terrible number were killed there. And it was absolutely, from people who came up from down below there, they said it was absolutely terrible down there. In fact, very few did manage to get. But for my own part, I was fortunate. I happened to be on the upper deck. Though the bomb had blown me off my feet, I was still all right, and I'd not been hit. And it was then that the express, the destroyer, came alongside, and they said, then they shouted across, "You're sinking." And they started to throw over the lines, and as you see in that photograph, in which you see me standing there, I looked at that and I thought, well, I don't know. It's a matter of, I call that my survival photograph. Always stand back a bit and weigh it up. Don't get rushing ever into things. There's always a time for a second think. And I looked at that, and I didn't like the idea at all. And some of these laddies started then to go across on the lines between the two ships. And of course, it was just on that that the Prince of Wales, gave another heave to port, and the underside of the ship caught on the underside of the destroyer and started to turn her outward. And as a result, the lines were parted down in between the two ships, and the laddies, I'm afraid, just fell in between. And that was that. That was quite, you know, they didn't have any chance whatever in that. And I then made my way forward, and you could see from looking at the water the oil coming out the side of the ship there. So I decided to make my way right forward, and if I'm going to go off the ship, that would be the point I'm going off it. And of course, we're now at a stage where, though no order had been given, it is abandoned ship. The express, when she started to turn over just and the ropes parted, she then righted herself and went astern and got clear of us completely, because we were obviously going to sink. I can remember looking down from the forecastle, and believe me, it looked a terribly, terribly long, long way down. And the ship had tilted over quite a bit by now, the time I'd gone forward. I took my torch out of my pocket, out of my overall pocket, and put it down on the deck so that it wouldn't roll. I put it at right angles to the fore and aft line of the ship, but it still slid all the way down the port side and went to the water side. I remember taking my overalls off. I took my wallet out of my mouth, out of my pocket rather, and stuck it in my mouth. And I can remember looking up at the bridge just about then and seeing the Admiral, who seemed to be fully in full rig, as it were. He was there with his epaulets and all the sort of, just looking over the side of the ship, making no attempt whatever to get off or escape or anything at all. He was just looking over there as if he were looking over the ship on an ordinary everyday event. And we did try to get one of the great big spars that we put out, the booms that you normally use for a boat, but this was far too heavy for us to move. And I remember starting off sliding down a rope, and the rope parted. And I remember going then down the rest of the, with a whole whack of people, and hitting the sea and going down and down and down and getting the usual thing. But because I had people behind me and fell on me, my wallet, which was in my mouth, I opened my mouth involuntarily and the wallet floated away. And that was that. But I can remember, you know, I felt, there are times in the war when you get caught napping, as it were, and that happened to me in the Mediterranean later. And when you get jumped by a Stuka suddenly, you might feel a bit of a jitter. Other times you're quite cool and calm, and this was one of the times, fortunately, when I was quite cool and calm. And I can remember thinking to myself, with all these struggling arms and legs above me, and I swam outwards instead of upwards. I swam as if I was going to swim underwater for some distance. So I swam out and then came to the surface. Pardon me. And I came to the surface, and as I came to the surface and looked around the ship, then you could hear all the kind of, it's a dreadful thing when a ship sinks, there's all the breaking of bulkheads inside the thing, and the crunching and all that sort of thing going on. And she was then starting to heave up on the stern, and the bows were getting higher in the air. And I can remember there was a laddie about the end of the row, I suppose he must have been about a good 10 yards away, saying, oh dear, I can't make this sort of thing. And then I turned back at the ship and thought, gosh, what's happening here? Is it going to have another look at the thing? And it was then starting to go more and more up on end. And I can remember seeing some Marines come out to the turret of S1. About me. And they ran down the side of the ship. And as the ship tilted up a bit more, they turned and looked and thought, good heavens, you know, we're going the wrong way. And they turned then and rang the length of the ship down, as if along the side of the ship, as well, and partly along the bottom, as if they were going off Bournemouth Beach and getting deeper and deeper, and then struck out. And that was quite a sight. But then I turned back, and this laddie then had disappeared, and it was quite clear. And then it's time I started to swim. And when I looked back, then she'd gone down. And I thought then that an aircraft came over, Japanese, and I thought, well, are we going to get machine gun? But not, none of us at all. They moved off, cleared away, and then I started to swim outside the main group. I thought, I'd keep clear of this and all the oil. And then a Brewster Buffalo from Singapore flew above us, and you know, and that poor chap arrived too late, and we found later it's not his fault at all, but he didn't get exactly a very good reception from the lads who didn't know. But I swam around this whole lot, the survivors, and I could see the express, which had pulled the stone from us when it started to be turned over, and I started to aim for that and started to swim towards it. And just as I was getting near it, I could see its screw start to turn, and it started to ease forward into the main group of survivors to pick them up, which would have left me right out on the circumference again. And I thought, good God, and it's the fastest 100-yard swim I've done in my life. And I can remember just catching her right by the after screen, right by the quarter deck, and grabbing a scrambling net, because in survival situations you put what are called scrambling nets over the sides of ships, and grabbing the scrambling net and hanging on, entwining my arms in this thing and panting very, very much until I'd gained my breath a bit. And then I climbed up the scrambling net and just hung there, and a chappy came along and looked over the side. I won't say precisely what he said, but it was something like, goodness me, what have we got here? Leaned over, grabbed me and rucked my shirt up and just pulled me over and dropped me on the deck of the quarter deck of the express like a, you know, a wet haddock, for which I was very, very pleased, wet haddock or not. And he thrust then a great big cup of rum in my hand.
How did they treat you aboard the express?
Oh, very well. Very well indeed. Aboard the express, of course, one must bear in mind that here you have a ship of some 1,500 tons, a destroyer. In attendance, of course, also was an Electra, the same class, and the Vampire, a smaller V&W. And they had to cope with all these survivors. And they did extremely well. The express picked up, I should imagine, most of the Prince of Wales. The Electra picked up more repulse survivors. But it was a matter that here rum was flowing quite freely, which no doubt proved, pleased the Jack Dusty on there, the supply PO, because it enabled him, I suppose, to balance his books. But the picking up part, again, was very, very mixed, as it were, in emotion. In that here, there was the elation that one was a survivor, that you'd survived it, here you are for the moment at least. I mean, the Japanese might attack you, it is true, and you didn't know quite what's going to happen, but at least you had a ship. The ship you were in with all your possessions was no more. There was a blank sea, and I think there's nothing, no greater feeling of loneliness as this, what I felt in the water when the Prince of Wales had sunk. You just turn and you look, and there's just nothing. It was something similar to when the Hood sank. The sea is a great... Well, as we know from the refuse we get and the way we dump it in the sea, we hide everything in the sea. And you felt that too with the ships, that there they were at one moment and there they weren't. They were gone. And you were very much alone. So the feeling that once you were in the express, you were for the moment safe, and there was that feeling of elation at being safe.